Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 9:08 a.m. Friday, the 29th of April, 2010. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, and Senator Olson will be joining us momentarily, and myself, Stedman. We have several bills on the agenda today. We're scheduled for morning and afternoon, so what we don't complete this morning, we'll pick up this afternoon, and then we have some work this afternoon. Also, this afternoon, there's a picture, I think, at 1:30, out on the front steps, possibly?
1:00.
Or 1 o'clock, or whenever it is. So we'll, our meeting is scheduled for 1:30. There's also a conflict with a bill presentation in the House, so most likely the afternoon session will start a little late, but we'll keep it posted and keep everybody informed. We're going to start today's labor with House Bill 10, Municipal Taxes Cost Exemption, House Bill 98, Alcohol Minor Consuming Local Option, House Bill 92, Grants to Disaster Victims, House Bill 334, Military Deployment of Child Custody, Senate Bill 222, Sex Offenders, Offender Registry and Sentencing, Senate Bill 255, Fish Processors Fees, License and Records, and finish up with Senate Bill 292, dealing with pawnbrokers. First bill up is Senate Bill 10 by Representative Gruenberg regarding municipal tax exemptions. This is the first hearing on this bill. It was scheduled last session but was not heard. The intent today is to adopt a committee substitute, have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. Senator Hoffman, may I have a motion to adopt the committee substitute version Z as in zebra?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt Senate CS for House Bill 10, Finance /Z as our working document.
I'll object for an explanation, and Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Stedman. The Senate Committee Substitute for House Bill 10, Version Z, includes four tax exemptions included in statute. The first two are found in Section 1. Section 1 is the AS 2945030, which are the mandatory tax exemptions in state statute. The first change is found on page 1, starting on line 14. This is the tax exemption that refers to the Dong Mountain Transportation System. The exemption would exempt them from assessment and the full value determination of the Northwest Arctic Borough. It also applies retroactively to November 30th, 2009, when the current exemption expired. And there's also a sunset provision at the end of the bill that sunsets this in November 2012. The second mandatory tax exemption in that section number 1, Mr. Chairman, is found on page 3, line 10. And this is the tax exemption for the Alaska Pacific University, which we have discussed before this committee. Mr. Chairman, the reason behind this mandatory tax exemption is the municipality of Anchorage began assessing property taxes on the Alaska Pacific University property around January 2006. That was the first time that the university has been taxed in its 47 years of tax-free history in Alaska. Prior to that assessment, the municipality treated the Alaska Pacific University similar to the University of Alaska. The properties in question are the Marriott Hotel, which pays all municipal property and bed taxes. The university has a ground lease with the hotel, and the ground lease requires the hotel to pay the taxes. The property that is a controversial piece is the Alaska Spine Institute, which has been billed by the municipality for property taxes and hasn't paid it yet. The reason why is because when the university entered into a lease with the Spine Institute, their grounds were tax exempt, so the tax costs were not calculated into the lease. So the university, so the municipality is now assessing taxes on the Spine Institute, but they're not required to pay because of the terms of their lease. So those tax bills are going to the university. The Spine Institute lease terminates in 2035, and so if you look on the very last line of the bill, page 8, line 9, section 9 of the bill, we have a sunset clause for that tax exemption, which will be repealed in 2035. After that, the university would calculate all property tax costs into their future leases, is my understanding, Mr. Chairman. Section 2 of the bill is the sunset provision for the DeLong Mountain Transportation System on November 30th, 2012. Section 3 of the bill would remove the private land from the university, so private land, if it's not used for educational purposes, would be taxable as of December 31st, 2035. Section 4 of the bill, page 6, this tax exemption allows widows and widowers of disabled veterans to qualify for and retain their municipal property tax exemption regardless of their age. This tax exemption, Mr. Chairman, is an optional tax exemption, and furthermore, it must be ratified by the voters of the municipality. And finally, Mr. Chairman, Section 5 is the last tax exemption found in House Bill 10. This is the tax exemption for law enforcement officers to purchase homes in high crime areas. It allows the municipality, if they choose, to pass an ordinance giving an exemption up to $150,000 on the assessed value. Those are the extent of the exemptions in the bill, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions on the CS? Seeing none, I'll go ahead and remove my objection for the adoption of the CS version Z as our working document now. Do we have any, or maybe we have the bill sponsor come forward, please? You can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and walk us through the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Max Gruenberg. I represent House District 20, which is Mountain View, Russian Jack, and Turpin in Anchorage. And I have my assistant, Ted Madsen, here to my left. Appreciate your hearing the bill. And I don't have much to add to what Mr. Peterson said. I know you're very pressed for time. I can go through it again if you wish.
Do we have any initial questions for Representative Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a question. I just want to comment on how critical this bill is with the challenges that are facing the Red Dog Mine in this particular situation and the school funding that's going on. This is one of those bills that we've been able to go, and the sponsor of the bill has been gracious enough to go ahead and allow us to get an extension of the exemption on there after the assessor for the first time in 1999 went ahead and started the assessment of the area. So I appreciate the sponsor allowing us to put this exemption on there, and I appreciate you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this bill, because it's ultra critical at this particular point because of the critical situation up there.
Okay, thank you. We have any other comments, questions before we go to the public? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, just briefly, I would ditto the senator from Nome. Comments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You're seeing no further.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to thank you personally for your help on this and the other senators on this committee and others and representatives too who have helped get this bill to this point. I'm very deeply grateful to all of you.
We'll go to the public hearing portion here in a minute. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just curious about the fiscal note. I find only a zero fiscal note, and it seems every time we've had some kind of property exemption up before us in the past, there was a large figure on the fiscal note in one respect or another, and I was just curious why there is zero here, because I know the state assessor has even weighed in the previous ones. I'm not saying I'm adverse to the bill. I'm just curious if I'm missing a fiscal note or not.
Well, that's the next on my list is to go through the fiscal notes and then the public hearing.
Okay, all right.
So that is an issue. There is one zero fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. We will request an updated fiscal note for the committee substitute. even though the fiscal note is zero. There's a memorandum from the Assistant State Assessor in your packet that identifies the potential fiscal impacts to the municipalities. Any other questions before we go to the public comment? Okay, we'll go ahead and have the public comment period. We're going to ask people to try to keep their comments to 2 minutes so we can move through our agenda today. Identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and then speak to the bill, please. We'll start in Anchorage with Marty McGee.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me? This is Marty McGee. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please, and who you represent.
My name is Marty McGee. I'm the assessor for the municipality of Anchorage. I'm speaking on behalf of the municipality of Anchorage. Our primary interest in the bill has to do with the university property and the provisions for the exemption of the university property. First of all, the municipality has never regarded Alaska Pacific University as having the same status as the University of Alaska. University of Alaska is exempt because it's a subdivision of the state. It's owned by the government. APU has been exempt because its property was acquired from the federal government in a land grant dedicating it to an educational purpose, and there's a statutory educational purpose that's a mandatory statutory exemption. However, the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska has defined educational purpose very narrowly, and so a building built with the purpose of renting it to receive income is not subject to the educational exemption. The hospital and the medical office building both fall in that category. My read of the bill is different than what was represented, and I'm particularly concerned with the provision for the effective date of the bill in the final section, which I believe is
Section 9
of this version. I'm working on a brand new version here. I've only seen it for about a minute. If my read of the effective date means that the possessory interest, the interest of the tenants in the spine clinic, would not be taxable until 2035. So the building under this bill, as presented, would be entirely exempt from tax until 2035. Maybe I'm interpreting this wrong, but that's the way I read what I see in front of me today. In any version of this, if this were to pass, the tax revenue from both the hospital and the medical office building would be significantly less than what it is today, where it's taxed at its full value. We have no intention of taxing any portion of Alaska Pacific University, which is used exclusively for educational purpose. That's exempt by mandatory state exemption as it exists today. I believe that's the extent of my testimony on this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony today. Next up, Mr. Rick Eckert from Homer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had come in to testify in regard to House Bill 10 and what I had hoped would be the potential for an exemption of property tax on fraternal organizations.
Eckert, could I get you to identify who you are and who you represent?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. This is Rick Eckert. I am the president-elect of the Alaska State Elks Association, and I live in Homer. I had hoped to testify in support of the municipal exemption for property tax on fraternal organizations, but I see in the current committee substitute it appears that has been removed. So I guess I really don't have anything to testify on.
Okay. So you support the now extinct exemption for fraternal organizations is what you're trying to say?
Yes, sir, I do. And I can complete my testimony if that would be okay.
You've got about a minute.
Okay.
Oh, it's up to
there
you.
There are only 17 elk lodges in Alaska, and they have contributed $2.2 million per year on average. The benefits of these lodges are then substantial, and the advantage or the good point provided by the old exemption was that a municipality could, on its own volition, review the value given to the community by that fraternal organization and make its own decision as to whether or not it wanted to levy property taxes. And so I appreciate you allowing me to provide this testimony.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Eckert. We're now going to move to Petersburg, Mr. Mike Lurer.
Hi, good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Michael Lurer, and I've been a resident of Petersburg for 53 years. I'm speaking today as the president of the Alaska State Elks Association, and until just a short time ago, we were in support of House Bill 10, or the version that that included the fraternal organizations. I guess at this point, I'm a little bit taken aback that it's been removed from it, but I'd like to continue on with my testimony with the hopes that maybe you'll see the wisdom of reinserting that particular section.
Go ahead, Mike.
Okay. The goals of the Elks are to provide community service every way that we can, to help those who are less fortunate than we are, support the youth of our nation with programs that are designed to increase their values, to forever remember our military and veterans for their service to our country, and to promote the spirit of patriotism. There is an Elks Lodge in 17 different communities in Alaska, with 11 of them having an auxiliary organization known as an Emblem Club. Both of these organizations are structured with national, state, and local officers, and both of these have structured community service programs. Combined, these two organizations represent some 7,400 residents in our state. Last year, the 6,474 Elks contributed $3,861,419 into the communities of our state through programs like scholarships, drug awareness, hoop shoot, soccer shoot, flag day presentations, Americanism essay contests, scouting, and support of our Veterans Administration clinics, as well as support of our active military with programs like Army of Hope and our Alaska Wounded Veterans Project. We also support other local programs by others like Operation Graduation, Close Up, Health Fairs, Chamber Events, and Salvation Army, and many others. It is our belief that fraternal organizations are a part of a small-town America, and if their efforts cease to exist, these small towns will suffer greatly through the loss of their support. If House Bill 10, in its previous version, is passed into law, it will allow communities to decide for themselves if the support of these organizations is worthy of a property tax exemption. Thank you for the opportunity to express our beliefs, and we ask for your support on the previous bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. Probably closer to 54 than 53. And are you not still an Elks state president?
I am the president of Alaska State Elks Association.
Okay. Thanks for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman.
Just a second. Senator Olson.
Mr. Willard, if I could ask a question of him.
Yes.
Are Mr. Willard, just to answer.
Sorry, I could understand that.
Michael Lurer is his name.
Okay, I'm sorry. Mr. Lurer, are you familiar with the other fraternal organizations, and do they get the same tax exemption that the Elks, the proposal in the earlier version?
I am familiar with some of the other fraternal organizations, but I can't speak for them. That's why when I brought up that we are a structured organization with national, state, and local officers, I was trying to make sure that only upstanding fraternal organizations are recognized for this exemption.
And Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank him and the Elks organization for all the positive things they do here in the state of Alaska.
Okay. Thanks for your testimony, Mike, and we'll see you in a month or so, I guess.
You're welcome, and you're right, it is closer to 54.
Yes. We were in Cub Scouts together. Takes care of the off-net. There's a few on here for questions. We'll go to Kathy Wasserman in the room. She's the only one that signed up, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kathy Wasserman, Alaska Municipal League. While all of the exemptions in House Bill 10 are very worthy organizations or companies and help municipalities in the state of Alaska throughout, I just wanted to, without picking on any particular organization or company, just remind this committee that the Alaska Municipal League has always held one of its main tenets to be that we are opposed to mandatory property tax exemptions. We believe that property tax is a local authority and should be made with local decisions. Again, we haven't fallen on our sword on this one to come out in huge force. We just would like the committee to be reminded that mandatory, we usually take a stand against, and we believe that property tax exemptions should be local control.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That concludes our public hearing portion. If we could have the bill sponsor come forward, please. Representative Gruenberg, do we have any questions for the representative? Representative Gruenberg, do you want to make any final comments on your bill before we set it aside?
No, I don't, except just to thank you once again. And I hope in your wisdom, you will take a look at the bill carefully. And if you have the support in the committee, pass it out. And if anybody wants to make any changes, I'm happy to look at them with you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Go on to our next item of labor, House Bill 98 by Representative Rammers regarding alcohol laws pertaining to minors consuming and the local option. This is the second hearing on this bill. We heard it for the first time on February 8th. The intent today is to adopt a committee substitute, have the sponsor address the bill, and look to the committee. Senator Hoffman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt Senate CS for House Bill 98, Finance /E as a working document.
Okay, I'll object for explanation, and I'll ask Mr. David Gray to come forward and explain the CS.
Chairman, I'm Dave Gray. I'm staff to Senator Hoffman. The main changes on this bill is the half keg language that's throughout the bill. And this language was stimulated by a resolution from the City of Bethel on February 9th of this year that urges the senators, legislators Bob Heron and Lyman Hoffman to propose and support changes of the legal limit for possession and transportation of beer up to 16 gallons. And the reason the 16 gallons was their desire was because a half keg of beer is 15 and a half gallons. The Bethel has had a vote to on and opted out of the local option status. So in effect, there is no control on what you can take in and out or possess or whatever in Bethel. They will have a vote on May 4th of this year with the option to try and go back under some kind of a local option status that seems more favorable to the citizenry. And the half keg of beer, it seems to be one thing that that really galls people, that they can't have that thing for ceremonies or whatever. So if you look at the first page there, where it makes a where it talks about the limits of wine or spirits or beer, and that's throughout the statutes, it includes the half keg of malt beverages, but it keeps the 12 gallons of current statute for all other containers of beer. And this in part was a desire of the administration, that we don't just lift the limits for all kinds, but to allow for the half keg of beer thing. So that's spread throughout the, that's your main change here in this CS. And the other sections, which again have the half keg of beer language, is conforming amendments. And finally, on the section 8 is again a definition to support the changes making.
Any questions for this? Seeing none, I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. Any further objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and we have adopted version E as our working document. We have representation from Representative Rammer's office. If you want to introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and walk us through the bill, please.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Jay Rammer's. And this bill is basically a fix bill. It corrects a problem from the 25th legislature on a bill HB 359 we passed, which was a bill that would allow juveniles not to be on probation for minor consuming so that they could get into the military, which we thought was a great place for kids to be and for youth to be. And so this will make it so that there isn't a loophole, because the problem was that although the person could be convicted of a suspended imposition of sentence under B1, it did not include a person who received a judgment of conviction under B12. This bill will conform the two so that there can be a previous conviction. It also fixed a problem from the Department of Law that there was an amendment added in House Finance that fixed an issue relating to bootlegging provisions that would bring bootlegging penalties in line with felony DUI penalties. And that is basically the gist of the bill.
Do we have any questions for the bill sponsor initially? We have 4-0 fiscal notes from the Department of Corrections, Department of Law, Department of Public Safety, and Alaska Courts. We will request updated fiscal notes to reflect the changes made in the committee substitute. We have no one online or in the LIOs that have signed up to testify, and there's no one in the room that's signed up to testify. So do we have any final questions for the bill sponsor? Will of the committee? We've heard this one quite some time ago.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out Senate CS for CS for House Bill 98 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Do we have notes? Do we have objection? Seeing no objection, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral.
Thank you.
The next item up, House Bill 292 by the Governor regarding grants to disaster victims. This is the first hearing of this bill. The intent today is to introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. With us today is representation from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And if you can go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is McHugh Pierre, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and with me for technical expertise and further explanation is Mike O'Hare, who is our Deputy Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. So before you, HB 292 really addresses a need that we've identified that's a couple years old now, And it's the fact that when we are faced with a catastrophic disaster and families are impacted under the individual assistance grant clause, the maximum amount they can receive when they have lost everything and they have no insurance, no money in the bank, no provisions to help them recover and get back on their own 2 feet to start the long-term recovery process, is a $5,000 grant. So we propose in HB 292 to link the state individual assistance grant to the federal individual assistance grant, which is given out during a federally declared disaster. Half of that would be $14,950 in 2010, because the federal amount, which goes up and down with the CPI, has dropped $400 this calendar year to $29,900. And I'll defer to Mr. O'Hare for further explanation of the bill.
Mr. O'Hare.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mike O'Hare, Deputy Director of Homeland Security Emergency Management for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And as the Deputy Commissioner said, this is HB 292 increases a cap that's been established since 1977. Primarily, we're just trying to modernize it to today's economy. A task force was established after the recent flooding disasters last year to take a look at this whole concept, whether we need to increase it, how we need to increase it, and by what methodology we increase it. So there was a multi-agency task force established between Commerce, Community, Economic Development, Health and Social Services, HUD, and other agencies involved in disaster assistance. And they came up with this model to model after the federal individual assistance, half the federal individual assistance. They looked at this model. They thought it a fair model, and this is the legislation before you. I just wanted to add that no matter what the cap is, our department doesn't just cut checks as we go for disaster victims. There's a real process of applications for the victims. We have teams of individuals that go out to those affected communities, take applications, verify the losses, whether it be photographs, receipts, testimony from community leadership, and establish the loss and verify the loss. So it's a simple concept. It is something that, again, we're trying to modernize it to today's economy. The current legislation doesn't provide enough relief for these folks. We've seen it. So we encourage your support for the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that testimony. Do you have any questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, we don't have anyone online. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on this legislation? Seeing none, thank you, and we'll set this bill aside for further consideration by the committee. That brings us to House Bill 334, Military Deployment. Do we have someone from Representative Thomas's office? Please identify yourself for the record. This is the first hearing on the bill. We did hear the Senate companion bill on March the 10th, so the intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and look for the will of the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Casey Schroeder Hotch, staff to Representative Thomas. Representative Thomas is tied up in House Finance, otherwise he would be here, but he does thank the committee for hearing the bill. House Bill 334 is nearly identical to Senate Bill 210, which you heard earlier this session. And basically what it does is it provides guidelines to courts who are faced with the difficult challenge of having to balance a parent who may be deploying and their interest in child custody if they are in the middle of a child custody dispute. The deployment tempo has been on the upswing during the past 10 years, and so courts are finding themselves in this type of situation more and more frequently. So some of the highlights of the bill are that, the first off, it requires that a court not consider deployment when it's determining child custody. It also affords a service member the right to an expedited hearing so that if they are about to be deployed, they can take care of things before they go. It also allows a service member to delegate visitation rights to a family member who has already has a close connection with that child, so that the child can maintain a connection with that side of the family while the person is deployed. It also provides for temporary custody orders, so that if the deploying parent who is deploying wants to allow the other parent to have custody of the child while they're deployed, this would be a temporary order, and the order would expire within 10 days of the deployed parent returning and notifying the court that they are available to resume custody. And the fifth major thing that it does is it allows for a deployed parent to testify in a court proceeding through the internet or with video teleconferencing, and that's an amendment to Rule 99. And with that, I can attempt to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Do you have any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the desires of the committee. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I recommend that the Senate move House Bill 334 from committee with zero physical note and with individual comments attached.
Before we do that, I do believe we have a couple of people that want to testify, so we'll hold that motion. We have two people online, Mark Sanchucci. Are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Mark, yes. Yes, sir, I am Mark Sanchucci, the regional liaison for the Northwest for the Department of Defense State Liaison Office. I've been listening to the testimony, and Casey Schroeder put it very well, and I've testified before, and I will save you the time, really, and just to say that 11 states are actively considering this right now. Vermont and Indiana have signed laws, bills this session, and as Mark Sullivan has told three or four other committees in Alaska, that this work that's been done up there in Alaska, it makes Alaska's effort on child custody for military the benchmark, the best practice legislation nationwide at this point, hopefully. And thank you for your consideration. I'm stand by for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, we have a motion on the floor. Is there any objections to passing out the legislation? Seeing none, the motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you. That brings us to Senate Bill 222, Sex Offenses, Offenders Registry, and Sentencing. This is legislation by the governor. This is the first hearing on the bill. The intent is to have the sponsor introduce the legislation, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. Do we have Sue McLean from the Department of Law here?
Good morning.
Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Sue McLean. I'm the director of the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Thank you for hearing from us this morning, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 222 makes important changes to several different provisions within the criminal laws. Some of these are necessitated by some court decisions, some of these are necessitated by oversights, and some of these are just to improve the criminal law pertaining to sex offenses. Generally, the bill the highlights of the bill is, first of all, that it provides elements for the crime of failure to register as a sex offender. And the purpose of that is to make it clear that the mental state for the crime of failing to register as a sex offender is that the person knowingly applies to knowing that they had to register as a sex offender, and that the conduct of failing to register is not knowing conduct. This second important feature is that it creates a Class A misdemeanor offense of harassment for those situations in which a person is a victim is subjected to a sexual touching over the clothing but does not have time to voice his or her lack of consent. And that is the result of some court cases and interpretations in which it has been held by some courts that if an offender touches a victim on his or her breasts, buttocks, or genitals quickly and stops when the person expresses the lack of consent, then that the crime is harassment. It's our position that that's a higher level of harassment, and therefore we're asking that that be classified as a Class A misdemeanor. A later portion of the bill also provides that if a person has two such crimes of harassment, that on the second one, that person should have to register as a sex offender. The bill also amends the distribution of indecent materials to minors provision to prohibit any distribution of pornography to minors, not just electronic distribution of pornography to minors. It adds a section that provides that part of the proof must be that the pornographic material is harmful to minors, and it defines the terms harmful to minors in terms of contemporary standards regarding what a state may regulate with respect to pornography. It corrects an oversight of heading the crimes of human trafficking, possession of child pornography, distribution of child pornography, and to minors to the list of crimes which require sex offender registration. At the present time, those crimes are not included as crimes for which a person must register as a sex offender if the person is convicted of those crimes. There is a section that removes the word substantially, that would be section 13 of the bill, when describing a crime in another jurisdiction that must be a predicate conviction that would disallow the use of a suspended imposition of sentence. That is, our statute now provides that a person can't have a suspended imposition of sentence if they've been previously convicted of certain offenses. And unfortunately, it says convicted of certain offenses in this jurisdiction but of substantially similar offenses in another jurisdiction. And it just clarifies that the offenses should be similar, and it tracks other sentencing statutes pertaining to that same type of subject matter. The bill adds conditions of probation so that courts may require sex offenders to provide their email or other electronic network addresses to their probation officer, and that the probation officer may provide those to the police. It also would allow a court, when sentencing a person who's convicted of a crime involving minors, the court could order the person not to use a computer or not to visit certain internet sites. The bill amends the current aggravating factors, providing that an aggravating factor which a sentence is aggravated by a factor in which the victim was particularly vulnerable, that aggravating factor would be amended so that if the victim is intoxicated by drugs or alcohol, the victim is particularly vulnerable. It also corrects basically an oversight. There is an aggravating factor in which an offense is aggravated if it's a crime of domestic violence. That current aggravating factor does not include dating relationships within the crimes of domestic violence, and this bill simply adds the words dating relationship to that definition. It adds a section, and this actually was added by the Senate Judiciary Committee, requiring local law enforcement to report sex crimes to the Department of Public Safety for statistical purposes, and providing that if the local law enforcement office agencies fail to do so, then the Department of Public Safety has the authority to withhold funding that local agencies receive from DPS until those reports are made. Finally, it adds a section permitting the Attorney General to issue administrative subpoenas to internet providers in crimes in which There is reason to believe that an internet account has been used for in the exploitation of children. The subpoenas would simply give law enforcement, they would subpoena from the internet providers the names and addresses of the account holders, and thereafter, having that information, law enforcement officials could obtain search warrants to further look into the computer of a person who may be distributing child pornography. The bill amends the rule pertaining to crimes involving child pornography to prohibit the court from ordering that the pornography itself be discovered directly to the defense or the defendant. Rather, the criminal rules would be modified so that the defense or the criminal defendant would have to view the material in a secure setting so that it wouldn't be removed and further distributed. Finally, the bill adds a section to the uncodified law of Alaska, again coming back to the failure to register as a sex offender, making it clear that the mental state for failure to register as a sex offender is knowing that one had to register, one failed to do so, and that a mental state does not attach to the failure to do so. I'm open now for any questions.
Thank you, Sue McLean, for that presentation. Do committee members have questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It appears that basically all of the changes that are being made are all tightening things up. Is that proper understanding, as seen from your explanation, if that was the case, of tightening situations up to make sure that we're able to prosecute people for various things, kind of making sure they can't slip through the net by claiming that they didn't save something on a computer in that case or this or that? Is that a fair assessment?
Through the chair, that is correct. We have had a couple of court cases, and you mentioned one in which the court held that a person who accesses child pornography with the intent to view it does not possess it. This changes the law to say if a person accesses child pornography with the intent to view it, that is also a crime. And it corrects several of those types of problems that we're having with the sex offenses.
Senator Thomas?
No, that's good. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Thomas. Further questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson?
Ms. McLean, how many people are going to be affected by this bill by tightening up the loopholes that are there? Do you have an idea?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it would be difficult for me to quantify how many will be affected. I can only say that there are court cases that we are having had a couple of these court decisions. There are prosecutions that we can't bring right now without these changes in the law. So as the senator knows, we do have a very high rate of sexual abuse and sexual assault in this state. And so there are a variety of offenses to which these changes will apply.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Further questions? Senator Ellis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. McLean, can we go back to Section 19 for a moment, which doesn't appear to be a tightening up. It, I guess to a layperson, appears to be an expansion of power for the Attorney General. And can you just tell the committee or tell me what the current state of the law is then, and then what specifically would be granted here to the Attorney General in terms of administrative subpoena powers? I don't know the difference between an administrative subpoena and a regular subpoena. So what's the current state of the law, and then what would Section 19 be expanding in terms of the Attorney General's powers?
Through the chair, the current state of the law is that if law enforcement officers want information about an internet account, the internet service providers have not been willing to give that to them without a search warrant or a subpoena. We have no authority right now for anyone to issue a subpoena except to subpoena materials to a grand jury, and the grand jury must have already convened and already been investigating. That won't work in a situation when you're just trying to find out who's the owner of this account. So this gives very narrow subpoena powers to the Attorney General so that the law enforcement officers don't have to go through the very involved process of obtaining a search warrant for the simple purpose of finding out who owns an internet account that is being used in the exploitation of children and where that computer is located. Having received that information, law enforcement would then have to go get a search warrant if they wanted to know more about that. And I would add that Derek DeGraff, who is the Alaska State Trooper who most frequently deals with these cases, is available if you have questions for him.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sergeant DeGraff. Are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
Would you like to comment on Senator Ellis's question?
Sure. Could you repeat that question, please?
Repeat the question, Senator Ellis.
Well, I was asking about the expansion of the Attorney General's powers under administrative subpoena in Section 19.
Okay. Through the chair, I can give a brief summary about currently how we have to get these records, and that might better answer your question, sir. Currently, if an IP address is identified by law enforcement as having being suspected of distributing or obtaining child pornography images or movies, we currently have to write a search warrant to provide to GCI or ACS or AT&T to give us those, what we call subscriber records. That is essentially the translation of an IP address number to a name and address. Upon receiving a search warrant from the court, we would serve that on the provider, and they would in turn turn those records over to us. The next step is we have to go get a search warrant after identifying a physical location now. Once we get that search warrant through the court, we're able to then further our investigation by serving this warrant at a house or a business. What the subpoena would do, GCI ACS currently accepts subpoenas from those who are able to provide them. Currently in Alaska, essentially that's federal agencies. We're modeling this legislation after other states who have also gone out and written laws allowing to use a subpoena for subscriber records only. This would be a tremendous savings to law enforcement in terms of man hours having to work to identify suspect accounts that we can therefore target with search warrants later and trying to identify suspects that are exploiting children through the internet.
Thank you for that explanation. Is there further questions of the testifier? Senator Thomas?
Just not for the guy online, I think, but for Ms.
Yes, for Sue McLean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the language on page 3, section 4, and there was a removal of some language, and I wonder if there was a particular reason, because there are some things that don't appear to be then covered in the new language, particularly prepares, publishes, or prints. And I wondered if that was being removed because it is covered in some other area that is more specific to that versus the idea, because this is the crime of distribution is what paragraph A under section 5 is. I guess I said section 4, but section 5. Lines 23 to 28 basically are the are my question.
Ms. McLean.
Through the chair, it isn't our intention, nor do we think that the law actually limits the conduct. Basically, this just cleans up the language. It would still prohibit advertising, promoting, soliciting, or offering to distribute any material that is prescribed under AS 1161-127, and that statute that I just referred to is the material is the statute that defines the pornographic material. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Well, that, if I may,
Senator Thomas,
you're getting at it. I guess if in some place else it talks about preparing or publishing or printing, because that those words seem to be left out, and it seems to be more specific in the additional or the new language that advertises, promotes, solicits, or offers, but takes out the language that says prepares, publishes, or prints. And I was just hoping that in fact that is covered someplace else in the statute.
It is, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Thomas. Further questions? Okay, we have six fiscal notes in your packet. 4-0 fiscal notes from the Department of Administration, Department of Law, and the Alaska Court System. 1 fiscal note from the Department of Public Safety for $123,500 in general funds to enhance data collection and hire 1 full-time criminal justice specialist. And the final fiscal note is from the Department of Corrections, showing a 0 fiscal note for FY11. But starting in FY12, the department anticipates the need for an additional funding to cover the cost of increased numbers of prisoners. Online, we have 2 individuals that would like to testify. Jeffrey Mittman, are you online?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Jeffrey Mittman. I'm the Executive Director of the ACLU of Alaska, and I thank you for the opportunity to provide brief oral testimony. I have provided to the co-chairs and to the members of the committee written testimony, and will briefly focus on 2 sections highlighted there. The first is Section 19, the Administrative Subpoena Power. This is one of those situations that the Founding Fathers addressed in Federalist 51, where they said, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. While the ACLU understands and takes seriously the issue of sexual abuse and exploitation of children, the problem is that the way our governmental system has been set up is with a system of checks and balances. The courts are the ones who would check that, in point of fact, a subpoena is being directed at an actual person who is involved in exploitation. When we take away a neutral third party who has the power to oversee these requests, we essentially open the door to abuse. In the written testimony I provided to the committee members, we have documentation from the U.S. Department of Justice that when similar administrative subpoenas were allowed to the federal government, in fact, abuses did occur. The records of reporters were accessed. The records of innocent Americans were accessed at times when they were not even relevant to an investigation. So the problem is not with what is intended by this section. The problem is that it opens the door to abuse by implementation of this section. Judges are available around the state. They understand what warrants are necessary for. They review them. And they're that necessary third-party check to ensure that there's never any improper activity by the Department of Law. That is not to say that Officer DeGraff would be involved in it, but Officer DeGraff will not be the person who will always be doing this, and we don't know who in the Department of Law will be reviewing those. Will it always be the Attorney General, or will their powers be devolved down to a lower subordinate? It's just the kind of problem where we have government and checks and balances to avoid abuses. Another serious area would be the Section 16 change to the Rules of Criminal Procedure, and this is where we are restricting evidence to be viewed by defense attorneys or their experts in the offices of a prosecutor or of the government. Essentially, what you're doing is you're limiting the right of a defense counsel to fully prepare for trial. And by making this rule change, you're putting at risk potentially convictions that could be obtained at trials of those who are involved in child pornography or other assaults. By giving a necessary appeal in that an attorney is not able to prepare without undue government interference. I know we're limited in time. I'd be happy to comment on some of the other sections or answer questions, but I want to be respectful of the committee process.
Thank you, Mr. Mittman. Do we have any questions? We have the next testifier is David Kaz. Are you online?
Yes, I'm here.
Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is, good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes.
My name is David Kazarian. I'm in Big Lake, Alaska. I represent myself and a group called Citizens for Change America. And I would like to testify on a section of SB 222 this morning in letter of opposition. I emailed this letter also to be included in the packet, please. Senator Lehman Hoffman. I'm sorry?
Please proceed.
We all want to protect everybody from any form of abuse, and I'm 100% for that, and our organization is 100% for that. We don't support any organization or individual who would like to abuse anyone. Section 17 of the bill reads, sex offense means a crime under, and I'm not going to quote the number, or similar law of another jurisdiction in which the person committed or attempted to commit a sexual offense or a similar offense under the law of the other jurisdiction. I oppose this bill as written in that holding persons in Alaska to laws of other states would state unconstitutionally imposed registration requirements upon individuals who have been labeled sex offenders would violate the Alaska constitutional ban on ex post facto laws being implemented. If a person lives in another state, a state which retroactively requires that person to register for a crime committed 50 years ago, well before the sex offender registration laws were created, and that person moves to Alaska, all due to this section of this bill requiring that person to register would in fact be implementing an ex post facto law by association. The Alaska Supreme Court has already ruled ex post facto registration requirements to be unconstitutional and added punishment to a person who has already served out their whole and complete sentence for a decades-old crime. If a person lived crime-free for decades, that person does not deserve, nor his children or wife, to be harassed and banished from society by having to register as a sex offender. If a person has lived crime-free, that person does not deserve to be punished further by this, the implementation of this law. By enacting a law in the good state of Alaska which says a person must register just because some other jurisdiction or state says so, that in effect negates the Alaska Constitution for that person and his children and wife. All people deserve equal protection under the law. All people deserve due process. All people deserve the protections under the ban of ex post facto law. I'm sure all who read or hear my testimony would agree. Your oath of office, which you swore to directly, states you will uphold and honor the Constitution of both the United States and also the state of Alaska. Enacting this bill would violate that oath. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Are there, that concludes the testimony from online. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, we will set this bill aside for further deliberation. Move on to second to the last piece of legislation before us, and that is Senate Bill 255, Fish Processors Fees, Licenses, and Records. To present the bill, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your permission, I'll have Tim Benintendi come on up and present the bill. What it essentially does is it affects the fisheries, some of the programs that are within the fisheries, and just goes to make them more streamlined, and especially in some of the end results they're trying to get to. So with your permission, Mr. Benintendi will give you the nuts and bolts of the bill.
It is. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. Mr. Benintendi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and gentlemen. Tim Benintendi, staff to Senator Olson. A program is in place whereby the National Marine Fisheries Service provides loans to groups formed up for the purpose of reducing fleet capacity by engaging in permit buybacks. And this is authorized by AS 1640-250. The Southeast Revitalization Association, or SRA, is engaged in such an arrangement, accommodating those in the Southeast seine fishery and operating with a self-imposed 3% fee on fish sales. This fee is the basis for repaying federal loans managed by NIMS. The objective here is to drop from 380 permits to about 260 permits. Senate Bill 255 essentially authorizes the Department of Fish and Game and the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission to release to the National Marine Fisheries Service individual fish ticket data held by the state. This supports monitoring the loan program by allowing NIMPS to confirm that correct assessments and payments are being made. Having highlighted the provisions of the bill, I wish to add that an issue emerged between permit holders and a processors association regarding the eventual final number of permits to remain active in the fishery. Senate Bill 255 itself does not address a target number of permits upon completion of the buyback program. While the permit holders group has expressed an interest of reducing the number to about 260, the processors express concern that too few permits remaining might impact the economic viability of the fishery and investments made in Alaskan facilities. A memorandum of agreement was struck last month whereby the Southeast Revitalization Association and two seafood processors agreed that no fewer than 260 permits would remain in the fishery after a successful buyback program is achieved. A legislative letter of intent was produced to solidify this agreement and passed in the Senate Resources Committee recently. Copies of the letter of intent and the MOA are in your packets, I believe, and I believe we have representatives of parties concerned and others involved in the buyback program here available to answer your questions. Senate Bill 255 is supported by the Commercial Fishery Entry Commission, several fisheries groups, and letters are in your packets attesting that, and the bill has 2-0 fiscal notes. With that, I'll see if you have any questions.
Do we have any initial questions for the bill sponsor today? Seeing none, we have 2-0 fiscal notes from the Department of Fish and Game and the Department of Revenue, and we have several people signed up to testify. We'll start with the off-nets. I'm going to change order a little bit. Let's start with the commercial fisheries entry position, Mr. Frank Holmes. You can come forward, please. And then after he testifies, we'll go ahead and start the public process.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Frank Holman. I'm one of the commissioners at the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. This legislation before you is actually the end of a long series of trying to incorporate a program that was authorized by the Alaska legislature in the year 2002. The Southeast Alaska Purseine fishermen came together voluntarily to create this association, and with the idea of trying to limit the number of permits in that fishery. Through state statutes in 2002 and 2006, the program was facilitated by the Alaska legislature, and the fishermen have come together with the National Marine Fisheries Service to utilize a federal loan program to repurchase some of these permits. The legislation before you is simply the end of the line in that in the loan program that the National Marine Fisheries Service has, they requested a process where they could confirm that the 3% assessment that was going to be paid by the fishermen in the Purseine fishery and collected by the processors was this legislation is a mechanism to monitor that assessment and to make sure that the loans are being repaid by the fishermen. So we have been working with the association and with the NIMS for at least 5 or 6 years on this program. We think that it would be beneficial. The one thing you should know, two things I think are important to the committee. One is that in this fishery, there are about 50% of the permits that are not fished, so the removal of those permits is not going to have a significant impact. But the future of the fishery will be enhanced by those fishermen that are left in the fishery. And the second thing I think is important as the legislators is that the state retains all of its authority for future management of this fishery. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Do we have any questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at the permits that were handed out by the Limited Entry Commission, are these something that can be transferred generation to generation, and so that they essentially go on in perpetuity, or after a certain period of time, do they get returned back to the state and then would have a normal attrition if we were not to not enact this legislation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the limited entry system has a provision that they call that was incorporated in the very beginning of the program called free transferability, and this was added strictly to accommodate what you're suggesting here. And a limited entry permit can be passed on from generation to generation by the permit holder, and it does not come back to the state except in a program of buyback such as before you here. And in that case, there's a provision for the permit holder to permanently relinquish the permit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for Mr. Holman? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. We'll start with the off-net. If you could identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please, and keep your comments to 2 minutes. It would be appreciated. We'll start with Rob Zwanich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Robert Zwanich, manager of the Southeast Revitalization Association, which represents all 380 permit holders in the Southeast purse seine salmon fishery. Our association exists for the sole purpose of implementing a program to reduce or buy back the number of permits in the fishery. This bill is essential to the implementation of our program, and its background can be briefly summarized. As Commissioner Holman noted, in 2002, the Alaska Legislature passed a bill allowing salmon permit holders to form nonprofit associations to reduce permits in a fishery. 4 years later, in 2006, Congress amended the Magnuson-Stevens Act, making our association eligible for a federal buyback loan to finance the program. I would note this would be the first time a federal loan would be used for a state water fishery. The loan will be administered by the National Marine Fisheries Service. The loan will be repaid by an assessment on the catch of fishermen remaining in the fishery. Before funding the loan, the Fisheries Service needs assurances that it can timely audit repayment of the loan and has a mechanism to ensure the withholding and remittance of the fishermen assessments. This bill provides these assurances. The bill language, with input from three separate state agencies, carefully balances the needs of the Fisheries Services and the buyer or processor of the salmon who is responsible for the collection and remittance of the assessment. The bill is supported by virtually all Southeast salmon fishermen and processors. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today. That concludes our off-net and LIOs. We'll come back to the room. Start Bob Thorstensen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Thorstensen, Executive Director of Southeast Alaska Seniors Association, and I think most of the relevant points have been covered by CFEC and by the manager of the SRA, Mr. Zwanich. One thing I'd like to add, that hasn't been covered, but it's probably in your packets, is that, you know, when we initially set out 8.5 years ago, and when I moved to Juneau for the sole purpose of achieving this fleet consolidation 6.5 years ago, we had anticipated to be much higher grant, much less on the loan side, of course. As it were, we were only able to get $3 million in grant funding, and our loan looks like it's going to end up right around $17 or $18 million. Phase one, which we worked very closely with CFEC, I hope you have some of that information in your packet, showed that over 80% of the permits purchased in the first round were non-residents, making this more of an Alaskan-based ownership fishery, as well as I think one of the more salient points for the Finance Committee is that basically you guys have already financed over 20% of this program. The remaining 78% or 77% is the loan that we're paying. This has a zero fiscal note. It's no state money involved. It's a federal loan. It's a nexus to a federal loan. So we're paying our way. So basically the federal government through state authorized funds that you authorized in 2008 have already paid for the first 22-23% of this program, and the next 77-78% is what we're trying to pay for right here. This seems like a kind of a simple bill in a way, but it's an exceptionally important piece. It's the link that really links the National Marine Fisheries Service in the federal loan program and a grant program to make sure that it can be utilized by state waters fisheries. It's a very, very important piece of legislation for us.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Next up, Mitch Eide, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mitch Eide. I'm a lifelong resident of Petersburg, and I've been purse-seining for, well, since I was about 8, I believe. And I'd just like to urge you all to pass this out and support this. This is something we've been working for 8 years, and we are you know, asking to tax ourselves to make our fishery better in the future. And I can't imagine what would be an easier thing for you guys to support. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. And I can answer any questions if you'd like.
Mr. Eide, does your children work on your boat?
He will.
How old is he?
He's 5.
3 more years, he goes to work.
That's true.
Any questions? Senator Olson?
Yeah, can you just give us an idea on what's going to happen if this bill doesn't go into effect? How it's going to negatively affect the fishermen that are out there, especially those permit holders that are actively fishing as opposed to those that are not actively fishing?
Well, Mr. Chairman, what could happen is we get this increase in boats, and we had that this last summer with about a 20% increase, and it went from being relatively easy to find a place to go to work to have to wait in line. And you know, more boats are not going to provide more fish. They're just going to split what fish we have up in more ways, making it more difficult for all of us to try and make a living.
You might want to define what wait in line means.
When there's more than just you there trying to fish.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Taking your turn to make your set, which could be hours sometimes.
Days sometimes.
Yes. Okay, thank you for your testimony. That concludes the sign-up sheets, public hearing process. Any final questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Go on to our next and final piece of action. Senate Bill 292 by Senator Huggins regarding pawnbrokers. This is the first hearing on this bill. Intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. With us today is representation from Senator Huggins' office. You can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then walk us through this bill.
Good morning. My name is Josh Temple. I'm staff Senator Huggins. I'll be presenting the CF Senate Bill 292. This is the CS that came out of Senate Judiciary, and prior to that, it was in Senate Labor and Commerce. Senator Egan, Senator Thomas both saw this bill in those two committees.
This is an act relating to the registration and operation of pawnbrokers, to the exemptions for pawnbrokers under the Alaska Small Loans Act, and to the exclusion of pawnbrokers under certain definitions in the Uniform Commercial Code and providing for an effective date. Currently in Alaska statute, there are only a few paragraphs that regulate pawnbrokers. We principally leave that power to the municipalities and boroughs. However, most places have not instituted any regulations. This would create an even standard across Alaska for pawnbrokers. This bill would protect consumers, and it would protect businesses in Alaska. This started about 4 years ago. I think some of you may remember that Josh Appleby was a staffer working on that at that point. And this bill is at a point today where it's seen enough eyes that it basically will codify what good pawn shops are currently doing. And later we'll hear from pawn shops who support this bill. Now, so what is pawning an item? How does it work? Well, basically, if you have some bills that you need to get paid, electric bill, something like that, take an item, you have a value, go into a pawn shop, and you give it to a pawnbroker. That pawnbroker gives you some money. You go home, pay your bill, come back in a couple weeks when you have more money, and pay back that loan with interest, and you get your item value back. And that's what this whole statute is regulating. If you take a look at the sectional that's included in your packet, I'll just walk you through this whole bill. Sections 1 through 4 basically take the statutes that are currently in place and separate pawnbrokers from that statute. It separates pawnbrokers from things like secondhand stores and bookstores. Section 5 is where we establish the regulations for pawnbrokers. 100 through 140, 0876, 100 through 140, all deal with licensing and what you need to do to get a license and and penalties for not renewing your license on time. 160 keeps the loan limit at $500. So if you go into a pawn shop with an item, pawn it, a pawn shop can loan you a maximum of $500, which is the current statute. 170 deals with who pawn shops can pawn with, or who they can work with. If you're under 18, if you're drunk, if you are dealing stolen items, or if you don't have proper identification, you cannot, under this statute, you won't be able to pawn an item. 180 and 190 deal with record requirements, and this basically keeps in place what is currently in statute and was passed a couple years ago. If you're in a municipality over 5,000 people, you have to have an electronic record. If you're in a municipality under 5,000, you can still have a written record. And that was said, that regulation was passed a couple of years ago. 200 deals with transaction agreements. Basically, if you go into a pawn shop, you get a receipt for a transaction. 210 through 230 deals with interest and fee restrictions. It keeps the interest rate at its current rate, which is 20% per month, which is allowed. 240 deals with the redemption of pledged property and also requires that you give a receipt when someone comes in and redeems property. 250 deals with extending a pawn agreement. If you can't pay on time, this gives you a minimum of a 30-day grace period if you can't pay on time. 260 requires pawnbrokers to keep your pledged property in a safe, secure location while it's being used as collateral. 270 deals with property redemption and unredeemed property and what happens in a situation where property doesn't get redeemed by the owner. 280 deals with a military exemption. Basically brings a statute in line with the Service Member Civil Relief Act and says that if a service member comes into a pawn shop, pawns an item, and then gets deployed, all interest and fees on that item are frozen until the service member returns and goes back to whatever prior arrangement was in place. 290 through 310 deals with restrictions on pawn shops. Restricts the employees that can be hired. It restricts pawn shops from having drive-up windows and a little bit of restriction on the hours of operation, as well as it says pawn shops cannot allow their customers to waive any of the statutes that were put in place. The whole next page, page 4, deals with stolen property and police and court hold orders. This whole page, 320 through 400, allows law enforcement agencies to go into a pawn shop and put a hold on items that they think are stolen. But it does it in a way that's not overly burdensome to pawn shops. This also gives people who think their stolen property end up in a pawn shop a way to get their property back. The next page, starting at 410, is another statute, or is another thing that is currently being done in pawn shops. It's currently in place, and it deals with weekly reporting. Pawn shops have to report weekly their total inventory to law enforcement agencies. So that's currently something that's being done right now. 430 allows law enforcement agencies to come in and inspect property in pawn shop as well as pawn shop's books. 440 and 450 deal with disciplinary action to pawnbrokers if they break the law. 460 makes this statute the minimum across the state. And Senator Egan, this was one that you had concern with in Senate Judiciary, and we end up adjusting it so that it met your concern to make this the minimum. So city like Anchorage wants to, or any city really, wants to set sign regulations or setback regulations or whatever they want to do, they can still do that with the exception of a couple things about fees. 470 authorizes the Department of Community and Economic Development to set in place regulations to adopt what is in this bill. 500 exempts things like commercial banks from these regulations. 590 and Section 6 both deal with definitions. Section 7 goes back to those first sections, the sections 1 through 4 that separate pawnbrokers from things like secondhand stores, and this is just another section to enable that. Section 8 also allows the department to adopt regulations to implement this. Section 9 deals with getting a state license from, you're going from a municipal license to a state license. Section 10 also deals with setting this statute as the minimum standard across the state. Section 11 gives the department immediate authority to start working on regulations for this, while Section 12 sets the effective date for the statute at July 1st, 2011, meaning that pawnbrokers won't have to comply with this until July 1st, 2011.
We have one fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development for $38,000 in receipt-supported services. We have nobody that's called in to testify, keep people on questions. We have any questions from the committee members? We'll go ahead and set this. I guess we do have a couple people. We're going to try to finish this up. We have been called to the floor, so I want to have your comments kept extremely brief. Identify yourself for the record and who you represent and speak to the bill, please, starting with Fernando Pena.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Fernando Pena. I'm Government Affairs Director for Cash America. We operate 5 pawn shops in Anchorage. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 292, a bill that provides a regulatory framework for the operation of pawn shops in Alaska. And I realize that you're under a tight deadline here. So I would just like to say I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you, and I'm in support of Senate Bill 292, and to thank Senator Huggins for his efforts to support pawn shop operators and consumers. Thank you.
Thank you. There's another fellow signed up for questions. That concludes our list. Do we have any final comments, concerns from committee members before we set this bill aside? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Unless members have additional comments, that concludes this morning's session. We're next scheduled for 1:30, and they're highly probable it will be postponed because of conflicts, but we will have an afternoon session. This meeting is adjourned.